Yeah, it's another month of job gains.
But is it really enough to move the needle?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Friday, November 4th.
Happy Friday, Jeremy.
Happy Friday.
Could the International Monetary Fund also come to Europe's rescue?
Concerts have been on a high note lately.
And waiting on the cable guy costs money. You know, time is money, but just how much?
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
The nation's economy created 80,000 jobs in October, according to the latest Labor Department report out this morning. The unemployment rate improved, dropping 0.1% to 9%. David Kelly is chief market strategist for J.P. Morgan Funds, and he's with us now from New York with the latest on that and some analysis. Hey, David.
Good morning.
So what do you think? 80,000 jobs, good or no?
Well, actually, I think the details are better than that headline number. I mean, first of all, they revised up the prior 2 months by about 102,000. So in a way, it's kind of like getting 182,000 jobs, not 80,000. Also, there's a separate survey which they do to calculate the unemployment rate, and that survey shows that 277,000 more Americans were working in October than September. So when we look at the details, it is actually a little bit stronger than that 80,000 headline number.
You mentioned those prior monthly reports that are being revised upward. Is the economy, do you think, David, growing faster than it looks like on the surface?
Well, it's certainly growing more quickly than people think. I mean, people think that we are in recession. We're not. The economy grew by 2.5% annualized in the third quarter. Even in August, you know, originally they reported August as having no job gains at all. You remember that 2 months ago?
Yeah.
Now they say that 104,000 jobs were added in August. So the economy's not doing great, but it is gradually improving here.
So maybe we need to wait a little while in order to see what the next month will tell about 2 months back. More than 100,000 private sector jobs I mentioned, government jobs keep being cut. Do you think these numbers will continue to be low initially?
Yeah, I think the government sector is going to continue to be a drag. We've got a lot of fiscal stimulus going away as we go into the new year, and state and local governments are still cutting back. But the private sector in America is gradually coming back here, and I think people need to recognize that. You can only keep the American economy down for so long. So overall, I think things are improving gradually.
David Kelly from J.P. Morgan Funds. David, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Chipmaker Advanced Micro Devices said today it's going to cut 1,400 workers, blamed on weak PC sales and competition from other smartphone and tablet microchips. And from AMD to AIG, the company that we taxpayers still own 77% of, it just reported a quarterly loss of $4 billion. That's its biggest since 2009. This time around, the losses are due more to the bad economy, though, than to risky bets on mortgage investments.
Groupon today priced its initial public offering at $20 a share. I swear we've been talking about Groupon a lot. They're going
to
do the IPO.
Thankfully, we won't have to anymore.
We finally got this IPO today, $20 a share, valuing the company at about $700 million. In other words, Jeremy, the deal is on.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
And now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. As the G20 summit in France wraps up today, the mood among leaders was upbeat. Now that Greece scrapped its plans for a referendum on more big government cuts, European leaders, along with President Obama, are also focusing on ways to stabilize Europe's economy. And the International Monetary Fund has emerged as the latest possible savior there. The BBC's Tanya Beckett is with us now from Cannes with the latest. Hey, Tanya.
Hello there. How are you?
And we appreciate you being with us. Why are people pinning their hopes on the IMF now?
Well, the International Monetary Fund has a greater firepower than anything that can be drummed up within the Eurozone. That's one reason. Already, it was made very clear that this so-called stability facility that was being set up within the Eurozone was lacking the firepower that was needed to push the markets back with their speculation against not just Greece, but now increasingly Italy. Really, if you were to look for a military parallel, you would say that if you have a larger bomb than the person next to you, then they are unlikely to use their bomb. So if the smaller bomb is the markets, then you are in a stronger position. And that has never been the case over the last 2 years. There has been inadequate firepower committed to the problem of Greece. So the IMF, if you adjust its role and you adjust the contributions to it, you might just drum up the firepower to solve this problem. That's why the IMF.
I want to talk about Greece and the options in tonight's vote. There's a confidence vote on the prime minister there, Papandreou. What are the ramifications, the economic ramifications under each result?
If he wins, Papandreou will try to get opposition on board to stick to the austerity measures to push them through, and therefore you have a slightly smoother path possibly. If he loses, there will then be an election, and that will of course take a few weeks to organise and to push through. Any delay in the process is uncertainty, so that would be bad for the Eurozone. What has changed very importantly in the last few days is that the German and the French leaders, Sarkozy of France and Merkel of Germany, have made it fairly clear that they are able now to consider the possibility that Greece will leave the Eurozone. That is effectively a threat now that the Greek people are looking at austerity or leave the Eurozone.
All right. The BBC's Tanya Beckett in Cannes. Tanya, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Back here at home, the firm that had a lot of exposure to the European debt crisis, MF Global, which went bankrupt the other day, well, the leader of that firm, John Corzine, is resigning. The company's board says the former New Jersey governor and former Goldman Sachs chief is now the former head of MF Global, and he will not be seeking any severance payments.
No golden parachute there.
I guess not.
All right. Big U.S. banks, of course, Jeremy, have been buying and selling what amounts to be insurance policies to offset any questionable debt. Sound familiar? Yeah, it should, because it's
sure
the same
does.
Kind of thing that caused all kinds of trouble at the height of the financial crisis. Here's Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon.
It was back in 2008 that insurance giant AIG found itself on the hook to cover billions of dollars in insurance on bad loans. Former regulator Lynn Turner told Congress then few saw it coming.
I don't think the company ever was honest with the investors about the potential impact of these things.
Now American banks are making bets on how Europe's debt crisis will play out, but Stanford professor Daryl Duffy sees no need to sound alarm bells.
There's no reason to believe that they've done silly things and taken excessive amounts of risk of this type.
Duffy concedes, though, there's no way to know for sure since reforms passed by Congress are still being sorted out by regulators.
For the time being, we don't really have great visibility on who's bought insurance from whom.
The banks say not to worry. They've got insurance on their insurance. But hedge fund manager Peter Chur says the uncertainty is uncomfortably reminiscent of 3 years ago.
Here we are with the same situation. I think that's a big failure on the part of the regulators.
By one account, U.S. banks could be risking many billions more in insurance protection on shaky European debt than the loans they've actually made to those countries. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
One more thing about Europe, Steve. G20 leaders are taking a particular interest in Italy and the political reforms promised by Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. But the Prime Minister is delayed over and over again enacting a series of deficit cuts. And now Megan Williams reports from Rome. Berlusconi, who is also a singer, postponed his release of a new album of love songs.
Silvio, dai, facci sognare!
That's Italy's leader Silvio Berlusconi singing a Neapolitan love song he wrote a few years back. The scandal-plagued billionaire prime minister allegedly crooned similar songs to the underage prostitute and other women paid to attend his now infamous parties he's facing charges over. But his latest CD of schmaltzy romance melodies won't be making its splashy debut this fall as planned, and not just because of the charges. Caught off guard by Italy's economic troubles, Berlusconi has put on hold the release of his new 11-song CD called True Love. In it are songs about yearning for caresses, as well as a Zorba the Greek-style dance melody, just as Italy is trying to ward off a Greek-style financial meltdown. With Berlusconi's personal popularity at an all-time low, Italians are more interested in action to save their economy than musical sweet talk. In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
In New York, the original Occupy Wall Street protest, the one going on in Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan, is now 7 weeks old. And since the beginning, the demonstrators' mantra has been, we are the 99%. So who exactly are the 1%?
For answers, let's bring in Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So who are the top 1%?
Well, the top 1%, they make more than $368,000, nearing $400,000 a year, tend to be middle-aged and older. They're married, well-educated, nearly all white. Hmm. I was surprised. Not very many immigrants in there. And then they're concentrated in certain occupations. You have your CEOs and senior executives, finance. Obviously, that's a big area.
Yep.
Doctors, lawyers, and I would also say media, entertainment, sports.
And is that group the same group that you would have found in the top 1% several decades ago, for instance?
No, I don't think that's the case. I think there's been a big change. If we go into the past, and particularly once we start breaking down the top 1% and you go toward the really wealthy, you know, in the past it was the rentier class. Let's think about Edith Wharton novels. Today, it's much more the working rich, the people who have founded a company, say, in the information technology business, or more likely, run a hedge fund.
Now, one of the arguments that we keep hearing out of Republicans, especially in Washington, is that it's not a problem that we have these people at the top, that as long as more and more people are getting richer and richer, that's great. That's the way it should be.
Well, the problem is twofold. One is the rich keep getting richer. And, you know, The top 1% measured by income, you know, they captured slightly more than half of overall economic growth from the period 1993 to 2008. So it feeds a sense that this economy is increasingly unfair. But the real point is about equality of opportunity. As the rich get richer, that means there's less opportunity for those who don't belong to that class. And I said, you know, that we had the change toward the working rich. We may be creating a society where the rich are simply people that clip coupons, you know, pocket their dividend payments.
Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And now, Steve, to an interesting prediction about the stock market from a new book called Bulls, Bears, and a Croupier. It says that based on recent history, the Dow, which is, of course, currently hovering around 12,000, will reach 100,000 in the next 20 years.
Oh, man.
Yeah, 100,000. So it does say that it will go down a little first before that.
Where was the Dow 20 years ago from now? Let's see. So that would be 1991, right?
That was right in the 5,000-ish.
You think so?
Maybe, something like that.
I'm thinking like 3,000,
something like that.
Yeah, so.
Well, this book reminded me of a conversation I had with a friend who bought shares in a pet medication company only to watch them plummet in value. And when I asked him about that, I said, oh, boy, I'm really sorry to hear about your shares plummeting. And he said, don't worry. In 20 years, they'll be right where I want them.
You got to stick to it, man.
Long term.
Yeah, long term.
We've got earnings this morning from Starbucks, which says profits were up 29% last quarter, thanks in part to Steve Chiatakis's love of Frappuccinos.
White chocolate chinos.
But actually, the other part of the earnings report after that was taken out of consideration is that Starbucks is benefiting from sales overseas. Now, as for their growth, they are betting much of that future growth, not on ventis or grandes or Frappuccinos, but on a tiny little cup that's about the same size as an espresso, Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
More coffee drinkers are brewing a single cup instead of a whole pot. To do it, they use special machines that use a plastic pod with the coffee sealed inside. It's a K-cup, and it's a business worth $4 billion a year right now. It's the fastest growing thing in the coffee market. One company, Green Mountain Coffee, has had a virtual monopoly on that market. It partnered with Starbucks earlier this year. This month, Starbucks has its coffee inside those little plastic K-cups for the first time. Bill Chappell is an analyst at SunTrust Robertson Humphrey. He says that will help Starbucks get more people drinking its coffee at home and at a higher price point per cup.
If you sell a bag of coffee, it typically runs you about 6 to 10 cents per cup of coffee. These K-cups, for Starbucks, will be selling them somewhere between 75 and 85 cents per K-cup.
Starbucks' consumer products division says K-cups can earn the company $1 billion eventually. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
It is only early November, Jeremy, but some stores have already offered holiday merchandise, and it's been out there for weeks and weeks, right? I mean, you're like looking for Halloween costumes and all kinds of decorations, and all of a sudden you've got Christmas trees and
day.
Lights. Yeah. This weekend, retail behemoth Walmart is trying to get a head start on the holiday shopping season as well. Literally a head start. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that.
Every holiday season, this is what you hear.
Wake up early.
Shop early.
Christmas comes early.
This year, Walmart is trying to get a jump on Black Friday with a big sale 3 weeks early. This Saturday, select items will be discounted just like the day after Thanksgiving. Candace Corlett is with WSL Strategic Retail.
The early retailer gets the shoppers, absolutely.
Britt Beamer, head of America's research group, says retailers are getting aggressive because there may only be so many worms, dollars, in shoppers' pockets.
74% of consumers say they're trying to stay away from credit cards as much as they can. So what's finite is how much they have in their checking account at any given moment.
The National Retail Federation predicts the average consumer will spend $704 this holiday season. That's almost $15 less than last year. And $50 less than before the recession. And consultant Candace Corlett says Walmart hopes the sale this weekend is a hook for more. To even sneak a peek at the specials, shoppers have to hand over their email addresses.
They will receive lots of offers from Walmart throughout the holidays.
To keep them coming back.
There is this fantasy, though, that then you stop. You do it early and you stop. And that's not what happens.
And Corlett says if it gets people shopping, other retailers will try it, too. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
So quarterly earnings from Live Nation came out yesterday. That's the music and ticketing giant that's responsible for a lot of the big summer tours. Profit was up and has been all year after a lousy year last year.
And the head of the company said their earnings are a sign that after a tumultuous 2010, the live music industry is stabilized and will remain that way into the coming year. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, are things really looking up for the music business? And here to talk with us about that is Jocelyn Vina. She's a reporter from MTV. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi there, guys. How are you?
Doing well. So how was Live Nation able to make such a big turnaround?
You know, I think that people are really feeling more comfortable going out and spending their money on things that they want to have fun with. You know, it was a really great concert, summer concert season. You know, there were some really great tours. There was Katy Perry. There was Rihanna. There was, you know, Britney Spears. There was Taylor Swift, who was, you know, selling out arenas multiple nights in a row in cities, which is a feat at any time, especially now.
I think even in the pouring rain, I heard.
Yeah, in the pouring rain, nothing was stopping people from going out and seeing, you know, her and many of the other shows that were going on this year. I just think it was a really exciting concert season, and people wanted to go out and see the shows.
How much are people spending on these tickets? Has that changed at all?
You know, I think a lot of artists have been working to find ways to make shows affordable for their fans. I mean, a lot of these shows are very expensive to put on. You know, the Britney Spears show, I went to that. It has multiple costume changes. It has, you know, pyro. It has these video elements that probably cost a lot of money. Same with the Taylor Swift show. Same with the Katy Perry shows. But I think regardless, you know, these artists are really, really working with their fans to make sure that they can. You know, they're working with sites like Groupon to sort of sell these discounted tickets so that their fans can come out and see them and maybe get the buzz out there and continue selling tickets.
Concerts, I know, make a big part of the music industry overall. Is this obviously a good sign? I mean, are we selling more records? We have more music out there on iTunes and such?
I mean, you know, records are, you know, sort of up and down. It kind of depends on the artist. It depends on the week. You know, there are the Adeles who will be at number one every couple weeks, always in the top three. There's the Lady Gagas and Lil Wayne's who are selling a million records in their first week. And then it's stable. It's not the days of yore where people are selling millions and millions and millions of records every week. But it's not terrible. I mean, you know, we're still fighting against the internet and all the implications that has in terms of how people get their music.
What's more profitable, the you know, going to shows, concerts, that business, or selling music?
For the artists, it's definitely the concerts. You know, they're making a lot of their salaries off those shows and the merchandising that comes with them. Most of the record sales, they're not really seeing a lot from that, mostly because of the way the industry works now and the way things shake out for artists.
Who do you think is going to be the big artist of 2012?
Big artist of 2012, you know, that's when Lady Gaga is going to kick off her concerts again. She's going to go back on tour then. I think that she is such a big name and she's such a marquee and she puts on such a show that I think she might step out and really prove herself once again to be a big force within the concert industry.
She'll have to get a new meat dress. I bet the other one went bad at this point.
That one probably isn't doing very well. So, yeah, she's definitely going to have to come up with some more crazy things. And I'm pretty sure that's kind of her thing, and I'm not worried that she'll find a way to keep us entertained, I'm sure.
Jocelyn Vina, reporter from MTV. Jocelyn, thanks for being with us today on our Midday Extra.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And finally, a new Zogbee survey says waiting around for an installation or a repairman cost American workers, Jeremy, nearly $38 billion in lost wages last year. Half of those who responded to the poll said they had to use either vacation or sick time while waiting for a service call. Now, this is costing the average consumer a whopping $250 in pay when they're waiting for, you know, all those folks. The worst culprit, said the survey, was the cable guy. Whose four-hour window, you know, it's always like, well, we can come
between
12 and 4.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It seems like an eternity.
You know, Steve, by the way, speaking of the cable guy and these four-hour waits, this is like the best thing I ever did back in my Washington, D.C. days.
You were a cable installer?
No, I was working at Marketplace, and I had asked the cable guy to come, and they said that they would be there between 8 and 12 to install the cable. And they called at 11:50, and I had taken the morning off of work. They called 11:50. They said, we'll be there at 2.
Yeah.
And I said, no, forget it. I'm not getting cable anymore. And I just canceled the whole thing, and I didn't have cable. Yeah, so I just watched the PBS NewsHour every day.
Did you really?
Which I still do. It's
pretty good. Well, you know, while you're waiting there, you and millions of others who are frustrated by that, good thing there's plenty to watch on ESPN or Lifetime while you're waiting.
If you have cable,
that's right. You can't do that. You can only watch the PBS NewsHour, or you can tune into Marketplace. How about that?
That's right. You can get your podcast. Yeah. We're still there, cable or not. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. I hope you have a great weekend. Of course, we're online at marketplace.org. I'm on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm on Twitter at Jeremy Hobson, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.